coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. Affordable housing has been a major campaign issue in 2024, but who's elected may not provide a clear indication of how the issue will be handled.
I don't think the legislature should just come and say, boom, this is what we're doing. I've got the vote. I'm passing this. I don't care what your feedback is. No, I think we care what the feedback is and do it carefully.
Contributor Paul Kiefer takes a closer look at affordable housing ahead of the election. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also delve into how much you can trust polls in this election cycle. Arts Playlist introduces us to a local group trying to teach people about the music of the Americas. And we meet the new head of the Mitchell Center for African American Heritage and History Matters. It's all next on The Green, where Delawareans get tuned into a first state of mind. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. How to handle the affordable housing crisis in the first state has been among the top issues during the 2024 election campaign, but work on this issue is already underway in Delaware. This week, contributor Paul Kiefer takes a closer look at that work and what options it may consider providing a new governor and General Assembly to address this complex issue.
The battle over how to fix America's housing crisis has up to this point largely been fought in local zoning boards and city councils. But as the scale and costs of the crisis become clearer, a growing number of state governments are stepping in to coordinate responses. One of those efforts is currently playing out in Delaware, where policymakers, advocacy groups, and trade associations, all part of the state's new Affordable Housing Production Task Force, are in the early stages of negotiations over a collaborative response to the state's escalating housing shortage. But why now?
Hindsight's 2020, but you know, things really changed during the pandemic. And one change was developers pulled a lot of building permits and started building a far greater number of housing units in Delaware than we had seen on average from in previous years over the past, you know, 5-year trend. So great news, everybody wants to come to Delaware.
That's David Edgel, director of Delaware's State Office of Planning Coordination. He says the state's residential construction boom has one glaring problem.
Unfortunately, we're stuck in this, you know, lowest common denominator type of zoning is common, which is, you know, everything is single family until you ask to change it.
He's referring to detached single family homes, a style of home that made up more than 80% of all new residential units permitted in Delaware since 2020. By 2021, median prices for single family homes in the state approached $300,000. In its 2023 housing needs assessment, the Delaware State Housing Authority found that the state's housing supply has shortages at both ends of the price spectrum. While it receives less attention than the shortage of units affordable to the lowest income Delawareans, DSHA Chief Strategic Advisor Caitlin Del Colo says the shortage of units at prices affordable to the highest income Delawareans can have trickle-down effects.
We know that we have very high-income renters who are renting units that are cheaper than what they can afford. That creates scarcity for people that make less money than them, and it just puts this downward pressure on the market. We also know that we have too few rentals that are affordable for people making between 0 and 30% AMI and 31 and 50% AMI. So we're being squeezed from both sides. And so that's why, you know, we know that we need to increase supply, but it can't just be supply for market rate. It can't just be supply for extremely low income. We need to be able to increase it across the board.
In other words, Del Colo says, the basic solution to Delaware's housing problem is building more housing and more types of housing. By her agency's estimate, Delaware is short roughly 14,000 units of housing affordable to the lowest income households and more than 20,000 units affordable to the highest income households. All parties involved in the state's Affordable Housing Production Task Force seem to agree that the solution will involve building more housing. But that's a delicate process, and not everyone on the task force sees eye to eye about what stands in the way.
You know, our state enabling statutes for zoning are like many other states. They're based on a 1926, you know, standard state enabling legislation that was promoted by the U.S. Department of Commerce, of all places. And, you know, so it's kind of regimented in, you know, you get districts and you've got regulations per district and all these kind of things.
That's David Edgel again. He says the century-old approach to zoning, one that treats single-family homes as the default in most residential areas, often leaves developers who are interested in building other forms of housing that could be more affordable to the average Delawarean waiting for months or years for approval from a local zoning board.
We don't want to go through a, you know, 6-month, 1-year, 2-year process that cost time and money and legal fees and things. And then maybe at the end, we don't even get to do what we'd like to do.
Elsewhere in the country, state governments grappling with their own housing shortages have opted to intervene in local zoning decisions. Last year, Montana lawmakers voted to allow duplexes and accessory dwelling units, or ADUs, to be built in most residential areas statewide, a move recommended by that state's own housing task force. Montana's law prompted a lawsuit by neighborhood advocacy groups opposed to density increases and state interference in local control. State Senator Russ Huxtable, who sits on Delaware's task force and led the General Assembly's efforts last year to shore up affordable housing construction and maintenance programs, pointed to a similar bill introduced by Delaware lawmakers last year, a bill he considers a starting point for the state's efforts to lower barriers to expanding housing supply.
Well, I think we started it with our ADU ordinance last year, right? We introduced an ordinance that required jurisdictions to create their own ADU ordinance, and we're trying to you know, thread the needle to make sure that they created one, but then also didn't put so many barriers in front of it that you wouldn't get any.
That bill never made it to Governor Carney's desk, but Huxtable says that its introduction alone was enough to move the needle in some Delaware towns.
Just by the introduction of that bill, several jurisdictions have started to look at their ADU ordinance and start revising their own. So sometimes it doesn't necessarily take an act of the state legislature, but it's engaging in the conversation.
But State Senator Gerald Hawker, Huxtable's Republican counterpart on the task force, argues that state rules, not zoning rules controlled by local governments, are primarily to blame for the state's housing shortage.
I've gone through so many zoning approval. That is not as costly outside of cutting down your density as DelDOT and stormwater and all the other state regulations. Zoning approval is usually county, and they're a lot easier to deal with than state.
Like Huxtable, who previously worked for an affordable housing developer, Hawker speaks from experience.
I'm in the process of now getting all the zoning and all the approvals to build a workforce housing project. We had a plot plan that we thought would get approved, and they, because of buffers and stormwater and all that, they cut the density down there. I forget how many, 20 some units. Well, when you take 20 some units out of the mix, that adds that much more to the total project.
He says the cost of keeping up with required infrastructure updates and DENREC rules can pile up, reducing incentives to build the denser, more affordable forms of housing his businesses need to attract employees.
You know, I run supermarkets, two supermarkets. I hired a guy from out of Pennsylvania I thought was going to come to work for me. He was in the process of giving his notice, and he couldn't find an affordable place to live here, so he turned down the job.
And Delaware's League of Local Governments, which also holds a seat on the task force, is firmly opposed to top-down approaches to expanding the state's housing supply. Approaches that might, for instance, involve the state requiring all municipalities to allow some forms of multifamily housing in all residential areas, as states like Washington have attempted in recent years. In a prepared statement, League of Local Governments Director Kevin Spence told Delaware Public Media that municipal governments are willing to make adjustments and work alongside state partners, so long as they aren't required to cede control.
The League does not support a top-down approach, but instead it reinforces home rule, which supports local autonomy when it comes to most issues, including affordable housing. Among those solutions, the League has been encouraging decision makers to provide a list of housing options from which local municipalities could choose which best fit their local needs and demands. What works in Blades doesn't necessarily work in Newark, for example.
Nobody on the task force, Huxtable included, is eager to upend Delaware's reverence for local control.
I don't think the legislature should just come and say, hey, boom, this is what we're doing. I've got the vote. I'm passing this. Like, I don't care what your feedback is. No, I think we care what the feedback is. We do it carefully.
And state agencies like the Office of Planning Coordination are preparing to play a support role as municipalities weigh their options. Edgel argues that so-called form-based codes are one such possibility. Compared to the century-old approach to land use on the books today in Delaware's municipalities, he says form-based codes offer a simpler path to approving denser, more affordable housing.
And that code might say things like, on this street, there, you know, two-story mixed-use buildings, you've got apartments up top and you've got retail down below. Or it might say, you know, in this area of town, you know, we're having a sort of row house or townhouse type of development, and your townhouse has to be 3 stories and 10 feet from the street. Go forth and build it.
Allowing municipalities to streamline their codes, Edgel adds, would likely require some clever legal maneuvers to work within the state's enabling statutes for local zoning, or a change to state laws. At a task force meeting last month, DSHA offered another half dozen options for municipalities to consider. New Jersey's model for mediating land use disputes between municipalities and developers, for example, or versions of the density bonuses offered by Sussex County. And while the agency is generally tasked with supporting affordable housing development, DSHA Director of Housing Development Stephanie Griffin says her office may even be able to help support projects that meet demand from Delawareans at the middle of the income spectrum.
We don't typically fund market rate development. It can be layered in. So like we have instances of mixed income developments where the capital stack does include DSHA funding, which typically finances the affordable units. And then there's other funding sources that come in and help finance the more market rate ones. And that's a model that we love to see and we are supportive of.
Most importantly, DSHA's Caitlin Del Collo says, the state needs to give municipalities a chance to take stock of the crisis and learn from other jurisdictions around the country experimenting with fixing their own housing shortages.
Time, I think, is a really helpful ingredient in getting communities to understand what the possibilities are.
Edgell shares that optimism. He believes the task force is a sign that local governments and private sector partners are open to solutions.
Each local government can look at their comprehensive plan and look at their land use and find areas where they would like to encourage that. Their plans actually say they'd like to encourage that. It's just going that next step and actually, you know, changing the ordinances and letting them do that.
But Hawker is not as hopeful.
No matter what the task force does and what, no matter what the task force recommends, under our existing General Assembly, I don't have much hope.
So far, the solutions he favors, namely rolling back state regulations requiring things like forest buffers around new housing developments, haven't received much attention from the task force. His discontent points to the growing possibility that efforts to address Delaware's housing shortage could become bogged down by partisan politics. But the partisan battle lines on housing policy have yet to fully crystallize in Delaware's gubernatorial race. In a debate hosted by Delaware Public Media and the University of Delaware last month, Republican candidate and State House Minority Leader Mike Ramone offered familiar talking points about local control and deregulation when asked about strategies to boost affordable housing production.
In the state, our job isn't really to write up the regulatory zoning and all. Our job is to create the business cycle that goes faster.
Democratic candidate and Newcastle County Executive Matt Meyer, whose administration has experimented with strategies like offering density bonuses and expedited review for affordable housing developments, responded to the same question by arguing the state could streamline housing production by centralizing the regulatory agencies involved in the process.
What I saw leading the county is that when an investor comes or who wants to invest in affordable housing, you have local jurisdictions pointing to the Department of Transportation at the state, who's pointing to the DENREC, the Department of the Environment at the state, who's pointing to the fire marshal. We're going to create a single office that that business people can go to, that housing developers can go to, that will streamline the process. You go to Philadelphia, 1.6 million people, there's a single government. In Delaware, a million people, there are 50, 60 governments. We need to make sure they're all working together.
While the question didn't stir up any sharp disagreements between the candidates, as housing policy debates seep into the platforms of presidential campaigns, the risk of partisan polarization on the subject becomes all the more acute. Over the past year, the Trump campaign has staked out a position in opposition to zoning reforms and housing density increases, arguing that those tactics constitute a, quote, war on the suburbs. And at a rally in Charlotte, North Carolina in August, Vice President Kamala Harris embraced the cause of supply-side fixes to the nation's housing crisis.
We need to build more housing in America. And so we are going to cut red tape and work with the private sector to build 3 million new homes by the end of my first term.
But for now, Delaware's Affordable Housing Production Task Force will remain a bipartisan undertaking. The task force will report its findings and recommendations to Delaware's next governor in March 2025. Paul Kiefer, Delaware Public Media.
Thanks, Paul. And the Green continues in a moment with a look at how much we should trust the polls with Election Day just days away. That's next on The Green, here on Delaware Public Media. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. According to most major polls, or combination of polls from around the country, the presidential race between Donald Trump and Kamala Harris is a toss-up with Election Day nearly here. But we've heard this story before, and the reality may very well wind up much different than what the polls are forecasting. So what are we supposed to believe this time around? Can we trust the polls, and why do they even matter? This week, Delaware Public Media's Kyle McKinnon sat down with University of Delaware Communications Professor Paul Brewer, Delaware Politics Director at UD's Center for Political Communication, to discuss polling projections and which numbers we can trust.
A new CBS News YouGov poll is showing that Kamala Harris is leading Donald Trump nationally with 50% compared to Trump's 49%. The latest 538 ABC News poll is showing Harris ahead by no more than a single percentage point. And in a separate analysis just from 538's daily election poll tracker, Harris was slightly ahead in the national polls, leading Trump by 1.4 percentage points. And there are fewer state polls than national polls, so we have less data to go on there. But most state polling data in swing states like Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin, they're showing a very, very tight race with Harris or Trump holding on to marginal leads. So taking a step back, when you see or hear numbers like that, what is your first thought? What do you make of them? What's your thought process look like there in terms of how you interpret polling data?
Yes. So in some races where there's maybe not even very much polling, like in Delaware statewide races, for example, there are very few polls, but the margins are so wide that unless something shocking happens, we can be pretty confident in making predictions about what's going to happen. In the national presidential race, it's the opposite situation. There are lots of polls done by lots of different organizations using different methods of varying quality. But the big picture is that these polls are so close that we can't really look at them and make a confident prediction about what's going to happen. It's kind of like an uncertainty principle here. When the polls are this close, it doesn't really mean that much when a candidate is 1 point ahead or 1 point behind in polls like this, because the margin of error is bigger than that. If you take all the polls and put them together, it can sometimes give you a clearer picture. If you take all the polls over the past few weeks and put them together, in this case, they still don't clear the picture up very much.
Yeah, well, and I do want to follow up on that. In terms of, as far as how these polls are put together, then the criteria, you know, when people see these headlines or see it on TV, read these news articles, that criteria, it's rarely you're seeing it listed. You know, we don't really hear about sample sizes. The minutia kind of gets lost in those headlines. And I think it'd be safe to say polling these days has become almost akin to punditry, at least I think in a lot of people's minds. I think it can be confusing and it causes a fair bit of anxiety heading into election day. So for you know, whether it's national or statewide purposes, how are these polls like put together, broad strokes? What kinds of factors impact polling there?
Yeah, so there is a science to it. Historically, the way pollsters did these election polls is you would do a telephone survey, you would do probability sampling, kind of like random sampling's popular term. And typically how they do that is they would randomly fill in the last four digits of phone numbers so that they could get unlisted numbers. And pretty much everybody had a phone. And a few decades ago, people weren't inundated by junk calls and spam calls, so they were more willing to talk to pollsters. So you might get response rates of traditional telephone polls like 20, 30, 40%. That's all gone downhill over the past 20 or 30 years. So now response rates are in the single digits, even for very well done polls. It's a lot harder to get. You want a sample size poll like this, like 1,000 people would be a good sample. That might seem small compared to a country of 330 million, but a representative sample of 1,000 people can tell you a lot about the voters' preferences. But getting that sample of 1,000 people is really hard now. And so a lot of pollsters have moved to online sampling. That's a challenge because it's harder to make sure that you're getting a kind of a random distribution in your sample because you have to get people to opt in. It's just tougher to get a hold of people. People are less willing to talk to pollsters because They're worried that pollsters might be scammers. You have campaigns that pretend to be doing polls, but what it really is a lead-in to trying to persuade people. So it's just a really tough era in the public opinion polling business for jobs like this. And so the polls are more expensive, but they're harder to do, and it's trickier to make them accurate these days.
When we look back at what's happened recently, specifically polling in 2020 and then during these past midterm elections, do those help inform or foreshadow polling accuracy for 2024? Should we read into those past numbers to inform what might happen, what we can expect this year?
It's tempting to do that. A little history here. So in 2016, the polls were off. And so if you just looked at the polls, the prediction you make, not a really confident prediction, but the best guess would have been that Hillary Clinton would have won that election. But what happened was the polls were off, and there was a trend in how they were off. So they tended to overstate Clinton's support. And so you look at polls now and you say, oh, it's really close in Pennsylvania, it's really close in Wisconsin, it's really close in Michigan, it's really close in North Carolina. The likelihood is that those states will all break in the same direction because of something we call correlated errors. So if we're wrong, we tend to be wrong the same way across different states, across the country as a whole. So that's the best guess as to what happened in 2016. Now, it might not have got as much attention in 2020, but the polls in 2020 overestimated Biden's support a bit too. We just didn't hear about that as much because the polls got the big picture answer right, that Biden won. And so people didn't really dig as much into the details of, but they still overstated Biden's support a little bit. So now it's tempting to say, oh, well, the same thing that happened in 2016 and 2020 is also going to happen in 2024, but it's more complicated than that. One thing is pollsters look at what happened before, and some of them try to correct for that. For example, they've tried to I should talk about weighting. So if you do a survey, you might get a sample that doesn't really look like the public. Say it's got more women than the American public does as a whole, or fewer people from the South. So pollsters will weight these polls. They'll statistically adjust them so that the sample looks more like the public in general. And there's a math to that, although from the outside, you know, people might look at that and say, but they're messing with the numbers, but they're doing it to try to make the sample look more like the general public. Pollsters could try to weight the results based on what people said they did in the last election. That has its own dangers, because when you start adjusting your predictions based on people's past behavior, you might be correcting based on the information you have, but you also are opening the door for new errors.
Yeah. Well, we covered state polling a bit, but not Delaware specifically, because Delaware isn't a state that has a ton of polls. And as it was described to me recently, Delaware is a state that is not obsessed with polling. So I can imagine why that is, but can you give us some insight into Delaware polling and if it's a good thing that polling isn't a major thing here in the first state?
Yeah, so I think the big reason why I don't see a lot of polling in Delaware is because Delaware's outcomes are fairly predictable without polls, especially in the general election. So Delaware's been a pretty consistently blue state, both in presidential races and in statewide races. So quality polling is expensive. We're talking $50,000 to $100,000 for a really kind of gold standard poll. So if you have a pretty good sense of what's going to happen without a poll, who's going to spend the money to do that? And maybe campaigns are, but they tend to sit on their polling results. So we're dependent on media polls. Or University of Delaware did a poll back in September. And what it showed was races that weren't very close. So Meyer, well ahead of Ramon in the gubernatorial race. Lisa Blunt Rochester, well ahead of her opponent. Sarah McBride, well ahead of her opponent. And the margins were big enough that they're way outside the margin of error. So something big would have had to happen between when UD did those polls and now for us to expect, you know, like some huge scandal or some earth-shattering event. Otherwise, it's probability. We could always have a very shocking result in these Delaware statewide races. But with margins that big, you don't need a lot of polls to have a good sense of what the outcome is going to be.
Right, yeah. What's the point and money spent best elsewhere? Well, all this leads me to ask them, Paul, why do polls even matter then? Why should we continue to put stock in them?
You look at coverage, and a lot of coverage is really poll oriented. You know, it's basically the scoreboard of the game. If you frame politics as a game, as a sport, as a contest, as a war, it's also a pretty easy way for journalists to talk about campaigns, because one, you don't, maybe there's not as much perception of journalists being biased because you're not favoring one side, you're just telling people what the scoreboard says. Also, if reporters become experts at kind of the game aspects of politics, like candidates' tactics, who's winning, who's losing, and polls are a big part of that, that is a reporting style that is easy to carry from any one race to another, whereas kind of issues, substance, policy proposals, they're really tricky and complicated to report on, both from a knowledge standpoint and from an appearance of being biased standpoint. But also, there's some evidence that voters like reading about polls, that news stories, especially for people who are really into politics, they really want to know this information. And so there's a demand for it, and polls fill in that vacuum. I would say that polls also serve another purpose that's maybe less visible, and that is understanding what voters think about key issues of campaigns. You know, where do they stand on issues like abortion? Where do they stand on issues like immigration, the economy? What are their perceptions? What do they care about? What are their values? If we want to understand what the public cares about and why they vote the way they do, and not just who's ahead or behind, polls can also be really helpful for that.
Thanks to University of Delaware Communications Professor Paul Brewer, Delaware Politics Director at UD's Center for Political Communication, and our Kyle McKinnon for joining us on The Green this week. And stay with us. Art Playlist is next, where we learn about a Millsboro-based arts nonprofit working to educate the public about the so-called music of the Americas. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. The cultural impact of the African diaspora in the Americas spans the Atlantic Arc, from Delaware all the way to Uruguay. Encompassing thousands of miles and hundreds of years of Africans in the Americas, this arc brought cultural expressions and new types of music that we still enjoy today. Something that the Millsboro-based arts nonprofit Echoes and Footprints is working to educate the public about. In this edition of Arts Playlist, Delaware Public Media's Martin Matheny talks with Echoes and Footprints founder and president Herman Boyd to learn more about the so-called music of the Americas.
Can you give us some background on your organization and how long it's been around?
Well, we're a Delaware-based nonprofit. We've been around, I guess, about 2 years now, officially. But I've been pursuing this for the last 5 years or so, kind of trying to organize my thoughts around what does Echoes and Footprint mean, and how do we kind of convey this to the world? You know, the essence of Echoes and Footprints is really to talk about and amplify the significance of the polyrhythmic beat that came with the enslaved Africans as they came to the Americas, and how that combined with the harmonies from Europe and other native indigenous sound to create what we know as American music or music of the Americas today.
And I'd like to ask you actually to expand on that just a little bit, and about the contribution of enslaved persons to creating a distinctly American style of music. I know we think, you mentioned sort of the synthesis of polyrhythms along with European musical influences, and my mind immediately goes to jazz, but it's a lot wider than that. The influence is a lot bigger than that, right?
Absolutely. You know, when I say music of the Americas, that really covers music that basically goes from Argentina all the way to, let's say, Virginia and beyond Virginia. So anything in the arc between that space is kind of the music of the Americas. And that music creation really is a kind of a product of that African diaspora. Jazz is certainly a big part of that, especially in the United States. But when you think about all the Caribbean sounds, all the sounds from South America, all of that is kind of derived from the influence of the polyrhythmic beat.
And my mind turns as we're talking about this to some music that was really formative for me growing up, and that's the work that Dizzy Gillespie did with the United Nations Orchestra and bringing in sounds from the Caribbean and from South America as well. And so that sort of speaks to the mission of Echoes and Footprints. Can you kind of expand on that a little bit and what you're hoping to accomplish?
Yeah, and that's a great way to think about it in terms of the mission of Echoes and Footprints. It is to amplify that range you talked about. That it's not just jazz, it's not just blues, it's not just rock, but it encompasses all the various genres in the Americas and South America, but also how that polyrhythmy becomes a foundation for much of what you know in the Americas, and how that sound really became the template for music around the world that we hear today.
We've used this word a couple of times, polyrhythmic, mm-hmm. polyrhythms. For people who may not be quite as deep into being music nerds as obviously you and I both are, what is polyrhythm?
So think of poly as many, multiple rhythms. So more than one rhythm. And that's kind of the unique aspect of it. When you think about the harmonies of Europe, it was nice, clean harmonies and, you know, layers of harmonies and everything. With the polyrhythms, multiple rhythms that came with the enslaved African, it became a lot more complex in terms of how do you layer those different rhythms? And they were not all the same, along with the harmonies of Europe. And then there's some native indigenous stuff that's kind of included in that. So polyrhythm is really the multiple rhythms being played at the same time. You know, a simple way to think about this, you since you're a music nerd, I'm not, you know, if you count in 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and there would be 3 beats here and 2 beats here. How do we get to a point that, you know, you slice this pie that you get to one at the same time? You keep repeating this. The goal is to make sure you land at one. That's basically what you're doing.
Can you draw a more or less straight line from the African talking drums and drum circle tradition to some of the complex polyrhythms that we see in Latin American music?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Kind of just a little background here. Of course, with the enslaved Africans, those drums were taken away. Human expression being human expression, it was a need to bring in that sound, that rhythm that the enslaved Africans had. And they started to replicate that sound and repeat that sound. They had to find new instruments, and those instruments were taken away. They constantly kind of reinvented those sounds and those instruments and introducing that to what they were hearing, let's say, from Europe. And that really started creating this complex nature of what we know today. So much of the popular music, including jazz, gospel, hip hop, salsa, rumba, all those things are based and predicated on that kind of complex arrangement.
Echoes and Footprints just wrapped up a round of engagement events with libraries in Newcastle County, yes. And you're hoping to hold more during the winter. What went on at those events?
It's, I love that question. It's kind of a workshop. Part of that is introducing people to the definition of a polyrhythm. And I start by kind of using a very popular song that people may know and deconstruct that song a little bit and say, what are you hearing here? And as you deconstruct that, you hear the polyrhythm that's driving and moving the energy. And that's the key thing. The polyrhythm really keeps it moving. Yes, you have great harmonies, but then with the polyrhythm, that's the thing that makes you want to patch your foot, makes you want to lean forward, makes you want to dance. We have instruments we make available and a very simple, you know, you play 3 beats, this side will play 2 beats. But you have to play in a way that you get to a certain place at the same time. And as the groups are playing these rhythms, at first it's kind of awkward. It sounds kind of jarring, but then they hear it, the rhythm come together. And once they hear it come together, they start, oh, I know this sound. I've heard this in song before. And this is what I dance to. This is what, you know, my friends go out and kind of party to. This is the type of thing I listen to when I'm, you know, at home. And you start hearing this arrangement, this complex arrangement that plays out in the polyrhythmic sound. It's really hands-on. We really want to make it very tactile and hands-on.
I love the fact that this is an ancient tradition that is still very much alive today in the year 2024.
And, you know, absolutely. And that's kind of the title we use with these workshops. The beat is the history. As long as you're hearing this beat, you're hearing these ancient histories of music playing out. And that history has kind of gone across the Atlantic, kind of created this new sound in the Americas. And now it's gone back to Europe.
I want to ask about one particular form of music as well. One of your colleagues from Montevideo, Uruguay, is visiting soon to talk about candombe, an Afro-descendant percussion art form. It's also a UNESCO intangible world asset. Can you talk a little bit more about candombe and what does this sound like?
So candombe is played with three drums, a large, small, and kind of called the piano drum. And it really is taking that rhythm and playing it over those three drums. But there are a couple of things happening in that. You hear the history and the culture of the people who are playing it, but also you hear the kind of the introduction of how do you bring this into the new world. But you start to feel and understand that it was about resistance and recreating human expression. So our visitor, Fernando, he's the person we engage with in Uruguay. He really has become a kind of our North Star in terms of explaining what candombe means to those communities. And that candombe sound, that rhythm, that culture, is really a part of those particular communities in Montevideo in Uruguay. And they really hold that culture true and try to maintain that that culture in such a way that, you know, it really expresses the history today, but also going forward, how you take that history forward.
And if people want to learn more about Echoes and Footprints, where do they go? What site should we visit?
Go to echoesandfootprints.com. And we've done a lot of work in terms of building out that site to make it a kind of an interactive portal. On that site, you can see kind of the African slave trade routes, for example. You can see connections from different parts of the Americas, which genres developed in which countries, instruments that are associated with those genres, key music playlists for those genres. So we're building out kind of a resource portal to not just place content. We really want to make it interactive and engaging such that, you know, you can understand when I say samba in Brazil, you can compare that to festejo in another part of South America. The music you know and love, and it's easier to say, where did it come from? It didn't drop from the moon, so to speak, but it has a history, and all this history is connected and integrated, you know, the time frame and the geography from all the Americas. It's really a connected kind of relationship. Yes, reggae is a little bit different from rumba. It's different from gospel. But when you deconstruct that, it's coming from the same place and allows us to see that kind of the long history and the connectedness of all this music and people and expression and the willingness to kind of go forward with this.
Thanks to Herman Boyd, founder and president of the Millsboro-based arts nonprofit Echoes and Footprints, and R. Martin Matheny for joining us on this latest edition of Arts Playlist. And we wrap up The Green next with History Matters and our conversation with the new director of the Mitchell Center for African American Heritage. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. The Delaware Historical Society has named Hannah Grantham the new director of the Jane and Littleton Mitchell Center for African American Heritage. The Mitchell Center works to promote the history of Delaware's African Americans, and Grantham comes to the center with an extensive background in musicology and museum work, most recently at the Smithsonian Institution's National Museum of African American History and Culture in Washington, D.C. And in this edition of History Matters, Delaware Public Media's Kyle McKinnon is joined by Grantham to discuss her new role.
I want to start with your work as a public historian with a background in musicology and museum work. Your research interests also revolve around, you know, music's material culture and 20th century Black music. That is all immensely interesting. So can you give us some insight into your background and those research interests?
Of course. Music itself is an archive, right? It embeds different periods of history, different conversations. We're constantly drawing from the past to inform new musical trends. I know a lot of critics of pop music will say that nothing is new, but I don't necessarily see a problem with that. I think we're just reformatting older things for new conversations. So I think that is a unique power of music to kind of draw us into the past and rethinking it. And it soundtracks everything. I think that we often, I like to use the example of like, think of your life as a movie. What were you listening to when? If you were replaying the moment that you fell in love with your significant other, what song would you score that to? The biggest moments in your life, you know, you defended that exam and what song was playing? Was it Rocky? Were you running up the stairs? These are big moments in our lives, and music is always surrounding us and it's always a part of that, even if we don't necessarily register that. Which I think is the cool thing about music, and everyone can kind of talk about music. I can go on overwhelmingly long about talking about music, but I think it's a common point that so many of us can relate to. But I think also it's such a great platform for critiquing in ways that don't dismantle, but offer alternatives or encourage people to think about the world differently. The Beatles did that. Stevie Wonder has done that. More contemporary artists have done that as well. I think a great example is obviously Beyonce. To go to someone perhaps less prominent, I think Rhiannon Giddens, who's a fellow North Carolinian, has always astounded me. I've admired her since I was a young teenager, but I think that her ability to bring historical research into music production is really thought-provoking, and it really exemplifies how music is this archive. It's a performative archive that draws on knowledge, that draws on embodied feelings and histories. The things that we don't always think to write down can speak to, those quieter moments of our lives.
Yeah, you are, being a musicologist, you might have the best job, truly. but in terms of this position, then, Hannah, what went into the decision to join the Mitchell Center for African American Heritage? You know, how'd you know it was a good fit for you, and what attracted you to the position then?
So I'll say I'd never actually anticipated staying in Delaware. It wasn't part of the grand plan. I came here in 2022 to start my doctoral studies at the University of Delaware, just thinking maybe I'd go back to Michigan where I was previously or on to the next adventure. But I managed to convince my fiance, a diehard Michigander, to move to Delaware. And we've really fallen in love with this area. People are so warm and friendly here, and everyone seems to have the history bug here, which is fun. We get into all of these really eccentric conversations about history. Everyone I meet here wants to have these types of conversations about the world around us. And, you know, the constant presence of history all around us is here. But I think also just people are curious here, which is nice, which is not exactly your question, but to bring it back to why I wanted to stay here. I was just surprised by how much I liked it here. I love how central this is. I can be in Philly in 40 minutes. I can be in DC in 2 hours. So obviously the location alone is desirable, but I think that these opportunities to work with cultural heritage and the kind of, it's almost like a think tank around here in New Castle County. You have the University of Delaware's history departments, the material culture studies departments that are in such close relationships with those programs in Philadelphia, but also the number of cultural heritage organizations, Winterthur, the Hagley, and obviously the Delaware Historical Society are these really exciting places that are rethinking how to do museum work and how to better center communities in this work, which is why I ultimately decided I wanted to stay here. I saw this job open. I was probably applying for jobs sooner than I think some of my advisors would have recommended, but I have never been one to just do one thing. I like doing many things, and I was very hesitant to completely remove myself from the workforce because I think that my academic scholarship benefits from my work being plugged into communities and regularly speaking to the public. I want to make sure that everything that I do always has people at the heart of it and is something that they can consume. And I think that the Delaware Historical Society is rethinking this type of work. And Ivan was probably the only reason I really considered this position. He's an amazing person. He spoke to one of my classes when I was at the University of Delaware, and I really liked the way that he was just rethinking how we go about our lives and processes in museums, rethinking some of the red tape that we often put up, but rather kind of figuring out how to be a more responsive organization, which is really refreshing. Working with the bigger museums, oftentimes you are stymied by structures in place, which are there for a reason, but sometimes prevent us from being a flexible organization that can quickly respond to community needs. So I think that joining the Delaware Historical Society and being the director of the Jane and Littleton Mitchell Center is a really wonderful once-in-a-lifetime opportunity for me to also, at this point in my career, where I've been here for about 10 years, but I'm really looking forward to that. What do I get to do for communities, and how do I really speak the language that I say that I'm speaking? I think that this is a really great opportunity to put that community-focused curatorial work into practice.
For yourself, Hannah, personally, your management style, how do you think all of what you bring to the table in terms of an experience standpoint and just you personally, how do you, think all of that can or will impact the center and its outlook going forward?
I'm a project manager. I really love project management and Gantt charts and timelines, figuring out what it takes to make something happen. And so I think I already have the privilege of seeing that play out. We have a few community projects right now that I can speak about a little bit. We've been partnering with the Mother African Union Church to amplify and generate more attention around the August Quarterly Festival. But I think already seeing how I can be a mediating force, but also an advisor to community organizations and working with them to help them tell their own stories and helping them navigate the processes of how to put an exhibition on, how to bring together a committee to help them navigate or revisit some of the research and how to amplify what they already know in more, I would say, scholarly streams or conversations, I think is something that I'm already getting to bring to the table. But I think also working with my colleagues who know the state so well, who know this history so well, and then putting our knowledge together with the communities to figure out ways to better make this information public. I've noticed that a lot of this really rich history in Delaware, people don't necessarily know outside of Delaware. So I really am excited to be a part of this team that's putting our heads together to figure out how do we get people to know about this? There's some really awesome things happening. It's incredible that the August Quarterly Festival has been going on for over 200 years. There are not things like that around the country. And just already in my early stages of research and poking around, I think I'm seeing iterations of that elsewhere. So I think that there's this spirit that we often don't attribute to Delaware as a gathering space and an important one, not only because of its regional situation, but just because of who was here, we overlook that. So I'm really excited to be working with people and using my experience in museums and my networks and my friends nationwide to figure out how we can generate more interest and get people to pay more attention, but also to really turn a critical eye to this kind of overlooked history and really getting it written down and put into interpretive spaces where it can generate meaning for the public.
Yeah, and I know it's still early. Are there any, in terms of like the biggest adjustments to taking this position, is there anything that really sticks out or is about what you have expected at this point?
You know, every new job has things to learn, but I think what I've been excited about is just how open I am here. I get phone calls all the time. I get emails from folks, which is really exciting. That happens at every museum, but I think in other museums, there's more of kind of a wall of separation in some ways that makes it a little harder for people to get a hold of museum professionals. But I've really loved the conversations that I've had so far. And I like that people are so honest. I like to emphasize to folks that I'm transparent, but also I'm receptive and I want to hear things. So if you don't love what we have on display, or if you don't love something, I want to know about it because I can't help make it better until I know about it. So I really love how honest people have been, which can be surprising, I think, to some people, but it's nice to hear it. It's nice to hear what we can improve on and how we can think better and how community members are already doing that work and how I can just help uplift that. I'm really excited about that. But I think the most exciting and also different part is just I've been getting phone calls and emails from strangers, so I get to talk to new people every day.
Thanks to Hannah Grantham, director of the Mitchell Center for African American Heritage, and our Kyle McKinnon for showing us why history matters this week. And that'll do it for this edition of The Green. The stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. You can also sign up for our weekly newsletter there by clicking Newsletters at the top of the page. And remember, The Green is also available via podcast at our website, as well as Apple Podcasts, YouTube, and the NPR and Delaware Public Media apps. Thanks to all those who helped make this week's show possible. Contributor Paul Kiefer, Delaware Public Media's Martin Matheny, and our senior producer, Kyle McKinnon. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Burns saying thanks for joining us this week. And we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delawareans get tuned into A First State of Mind.